Welcome to episode 1483 of the 1010 Thrive podcast, brought to you by 1010 Thrive Ministries. 1010 Thrive, 10 minutes a day, based on 10 guidelines for abundant living. In the previous episode, Salome watched her sons move from the familiar world of Zebedee's boats into the demanding life of following Jesus. She saw them encounter a man who could silence storms, touch those everyone else avoided, welcome sinners, and teach with an authority that continually challenged what they thought they understood about God. Yet she also saw that discipleship had not erased who James and John were. They remained sons of thunder, fiercely loyal, impatient with opposition, and still learning that the kingdom Jesus proclaimed would not be built by destroying those who rejected it. Acts of the Apostles, Part 6, Chapter 3.
I need to tell you about the request before I tell you about Jerusalem, because the two are connected in ways I did not understand until later. I told you at the end of the last episode that I had begun wondering what all of it would mean for my sons. What I am less comfortable admitting is that the wondering did not stay quiet. It found its way into action. And the action was not my son's finest moment, or mine. Mothers carry the ambitions they cannot express directly. We redirect them. We find acceptable channels. We tell ourselves we are acting for our children's good, and sometimes we are, and sometimes we are acting for our own hunger, for something we cannot quite name. A vindication, perhaps, of all the years of ordinary love poured into ordinary days, with no one keeping account. I am not excusing myself. I am explaining what I think was happening when I went with my sons to ask Jesus for positions of prestige in the kingdom. Matthew's Gospel says, "I came and knelt before Jesus and asked." That is accurate. What it does not say is that James asked me to come. The request was his and John's, and they believed it would land better coming from their mother. Which tells you something about my sons that they would probably prefer I didn't share. I knelt. I asked that one of my sons sit at his right hand, and one at his left, in his kingdom. What I wanted was not really thrones. It was an assurance. 3 years of watching my sons give everything. 3 years of watching Zebedee manage the boats without them, grow older, say less. 3 years of following a road that kept going further from everything familiar. I wanted someone to tell me that it would be worth it, that the sacrifice would be honored, that James and John would not end up having given everything and receiving nothing. Jesus looked at me with that look, the one I had come to recognize, the one that saw further into a question than the person asking it had intended to go.
Salome, you do not know what you are asking.
He turned to my sons.
James and John, can you drink the cup that I'm about to drink?
They said yes. Of course they said yes. They were my sons, and they did not concede inability easily. He told them they would indeed drink it. He did not promise thrones. He promised the cup. I did not fully understand what the cup meant when he said it. When the other 10 heard about the request and were furious with James and John, Jesus gathered everyone and told them that in his kingdom, the greatest must become the servant of all. He was not angry. He was patient as he always was, in the way that patience itself was a kind of teaching, but the cup. I did not understand the cup until the hill outside Jerusalem. And by then, understanding it did not help at all, but before the hill came the mountain. They did not tell me about it immediately. Jesus had forbidden them to speak of what they had seen until after the Son of Man had risen from the dead. Eventually John told me. Jesus had taken Peter, James and John up a high mountain. There his appearance changed before them. His face shone, his clothes became brilliant, and Moses and Elijah appeared with him. My sons had grown up hearing those names from the rabbis. Moses belonged to Sinai and the law. Elijah belonged to the prophets, and the promise that God had not finished with Israel. Suddenly my boys were standing inside the stories they had been taught as children. Peter naturally started talking. John always smiled when he told that part. Then the cloud came, and a voice said, "This is my beloved son. Listen to him. Listen to him." Those words stayed with me. Not look at him, though what they saw was extraordinary. Not understand him, though they were desperately trying. Listen to him. They needed that command. Because my sons were still my sons. They had told me the kingdom was coming. I had believed them. And when Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey, and the crowd spread their cloaks on the road and cried Hosanna, something in me leapt. The same something that had been leaping for 3 years at the healings, the feedings, the teaching on the mount. This is it, that something said, This is what all of it has been moving toward. The week that followed taught me what the word Hosanna actually means. It means save us. It is a cry for rescue, not a declaration of triumph. The people waving branches were not celebrating a victory. They were begging for one. And the distinction matters enormously because it means that the crowd who welcomed him was the same kind of crowd that would turn against him. Not from fickleness, but from desperation that had not been met on its own terms. I watched James through that week. I watched him watching everything. The temple clearing, the debates with the Pharisees, the teaching in the courts, the growing knot of opposition visible in every corner if you knew where to look. His jaw was set in that way he had. He was waiting for something. The confrontation he had always believed was necessary and overdue. It came.
Only not the way we had imagined it.
The night they arrested him in the garden, my sons were there. They had been with him in Gethsemane. The inner three, as always. James told me afterward, haltingly, that Jesus had asked them to stay awake and pray. That they had failed. That they had fallen asleep at the most critical hour of his life and woken to the sound of soldiers, and they had run. He did not look at me when he told me this. He did not need to. I knew the face he was wearing. It was the face a child wears when he has done the thing he most feared doing, and there is nothing left to do about it, and the knowledge of it will live in him from now on. I was there. I want to say that first, and say it plainly, because it is the thing I need you to know before anything else I say about that day. Most of the 12 were not there. My sons were not there. Not on the hill, not at the cross. After Gethsemane, they were in hiding, terrified, doing what frightened people do when the thing they feared has arrived. I was there, with Mary, his mother, with Mary Magdalene, with the women. I have been asked what it was like, and I have never found adequate words for it. What I can tell you is what I saw, which is a mother watching someone else's son die, and what I felt, which was grief of a kind that has no clean name, because it was not purely grief. It was grief and rage and something else, a bewilderment at the bottom of it, a child's bewilderment, the bewilderment of someone who had been promised a kingdom and was watching the king die. At some point he looked down from the cross and saw John. John had come. Alone among the 12, John had come back. I do not know when he arrived or what it cost him to walk up that hill, but he was there, and Jesus saw him standing with Mary, his mother, and said,
"Woman, behold your son."
And to John,
"Behold your mother."
From that hour, John took her into his own home. I have thought about that moment many times, what it meant that Jesus, in the extremity of his dying, looked down and saw his mother's need and met it. What it meant that the son he gave her was John, my John, the one who had sat at his feet and asked questions since boyhood, the one whose fire had been the deepest and the least visible. And what it meant that James was not there. James had asked on the road to Jerusalem for a seat at the right hand, and the man at Jesus' right hand as he died was not a disciple. He was a thief, one of the two criminals crucified alongside him. The seats at the right and the left were occupied, but not as James had imagined. Can you drink the cup that I'm about to drink? Standing on that hill, watching the life leave the man who had made my sons into something larger than I had raised them to be, I finally understood what he had been asking. I also understood, standing there, that my sons had said yes, and that whatever the cup was, it was not finished with them.
Salome asked Jesus for what she thought would be best for her sons, places close to him when his kingdom came. Jesus did not condemn her love or her ambition for them. Instead, he revealed that closeness to him meant something far different from what she imagined. She asked about thrones. He spoke about a cup. She imagined honor. He taught service. And when she finally stood at the cross, she saw that the places at Jesus' right and left were not positions of privilege at all, but places of suffering. We can make the same mistake. We ask God to bless our plans, reward our sacrifices, open doors, recognize our faithfulness, and give us outcomes that will prove that following him has been worth the cost. Yet Jesus offers something greater than the assurance that our lives will unfold as we hope. He offers himself and then invites us to become like him. Sometimes the answer to our prayers is not greater prominence, but deeper surrender. Not the throne we imagined, but the cup we did not understand. The remarkable thing is that Jesus did not give up on James and John because they wanted the wrong thing. He kept forming them until they could desire something better. That is the grace of discipleship. We may come to Christ asking for what we think we need, carrying ambitions we barely recognize, but if we remain with him, he changes not only our circumstances, but our desires. Eventually, the question becomes less, where will I sit in your kingdom? And more, how can my life be poured out in love as yours was? To be continued.